This is Richard Verone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Ambassador Fong, and it is now December 5th, 2002. It's a little after 10 a.m. in the morning, and we are still on the campus of Texas Tech in the interview room. Ambassador Fong, we left off, we talked about a little bit of stuff in your personal life, but we also talked about Paris. I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the Paris Peace Conference. What was your impression then and now of Henry Kissinger?
Well, I think that my impression of Henry Kissinger would be the same as most people. The man is extremely able. He has an exceptional intellect. And I was very impressed by his rationality, realism, historical outlook. But he was a very, very pragmatic man. That is to say, he tried very hard to find a solution to a problem from the practical aspect in order to accommodate, you know, everybody. And I think that he was very successful in finding ways to accommodate everybody. But we must honestly say that the foremost concern of Henry Kissinger in the 60s and 70s was to resolve American problems, the American intervention in Vietnam. He must first of all stop the casualties. Second is the insane spending over there. I would say then third concern would be the prisoners of war. And probably somehow find a way to save the Saigon government and at the same time secure a certain sense of honor for the U.S. to get out of the Vietnam War. And in the end, I think he was very able to achieve that with the Paris Agreement. I would not say that he had great merits to have that Paris Agreement, because the first merit would fall to the Hanoi people. The whole Paris Agreement was drafted by Hanoi. Henry Kissinger didn't draft anything and tried to change a little bit here, a little bit there, particularly after his meetings with President Hill in October 1972. And so I must say very honestly that Leinbacher too, you know, the Christmas bombing of Hanoi didn't change very much in substance with regard to the draft submitted to Henry Kissinger by Le Victor. And it was a very pleasant surprise, I'm sure, for Henry Kissinger and the U.S. delegation to receive that draft, you know, by early October 1972. He didn't even dream. And if they had to go through the drafting process, you know, that would take at least another couple of years before you come to any draft at all. And in the drafting committee at that time was rather the task of Bill Sullivan, who was the U.S. ambassador in Laos, and of Nguyen Ca Thach, who was the deputy foreign minister. And they were given the task of drafting various articles of that Paris Agreement. As I may have mentioned to you before, the only sole and unique time that the Saigon delegation had anything to do with that Paris Agreement was in the very last moments. That was by mid-January 1973, just a few days before the Paris Agreement was initialed by Henry Kissinger, Le Victor, and then signed officially on the 27th of January 1973. We were then, Ambassador Lam and I, asked to meet with the U.S. delegation, and Henry Kissinger gave us the task of drafting Article 8C and Article 15.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only time that we had any participation in the wording of that agreement. In addition to the 69 requests by President Hill to change a number of words in that draft, which Henry Kissinger explained to us that they were first a matter of terminology, vocabulary, misunderstanding in the translation and things like that. But then for President Hill, they were also a matter of substance. But in the end, Lionel Bacter II didn't change much in substance of the main issues of the conflict. But at least we had Articles 8C and 15 drafted completely by us, right, which were accepted without any change whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Did you help write those?
I wrote it myself, by myself, completely.
Okay. Why do you think the United States undertook Linebacker II? If it didn't change in much at all?
Well, I think that we have to go back into the context in time.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment it was, you know, vitally essential for President Nixon to obtain any kind of agreement. And it was made very clearly to President Hill that the U.S. would go ahead with any kind of agreement which they already considered acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So that first draft, we call it the October draft, October 1972 draft, it was agreed in principle between the U.S., between Washington and Hanoi, to be signed initially by Kissinger and Lady Toy in Hanoi on October the 24th. And that was his schedule, to go to Saigon and then to Hanoi and then back to Washington and then organize the formal signing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were prepared to accept that October draft.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the Hanoi government, you know, exposed publicly, you know, completely that October draft, you know, when they learned that Saigon refused to go along with it. And here, it may be of interest for people to know how that did that happen.
Yes.
When Kissinger went to Saigon during those 4 or 5 days, he met with complete rejection by the Saigon government of that draft. See? And Henry Kissinger only gave to President Hill the English version of that draft, really, not the Vietnamese. And then when, you know, President Hill insisted to have the Vietnamese, then Dr. Kissinger eventually gave the Vietnamese version, which then was even worse, you know, in terms of substance, to the compared to the English version.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, President Hill refused to see Kissinger again, and he had to work with Foreign Minister Lam and Special Assistant Nha and so on. And that was the big problem. But that night, the information came out of those secret meetings and reached Pham Xuân An, who, as you know, is considered the super spy on the communist side during all these years. He got wind of the thing and cabled Hanoi, informed Prime Minister Dong about the thing. They called in the Newsweek man and they publicized and released the whole thing to put Kissinger and the U.S. on the spot, because they have already agreed to sign on October the 24th that draft. And so Henry Kissinger had to go directly back to Washington D.C. instead of Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite understandable for President Nixon then to launch China Bucket 2 for all kinds of reasons.
Mm-hmm. You were in Paris during the bombing? Or were you in Saigon?
I was in Paris. Because I was called and informed, mm-hmm. during the night, I think, if I remember correctly, that the French Consul General in Hanoi was killed by the first wave of bombing. It hit the French embassy. And so I was in the, in Paris.
Mm-hmm. What was the mood in Paris amongst the participants at the conference when the bombing was taking place?
You know, we saw so many things already, mm-hmm. and so that was not anything really, you know, outstanding or exceptional. Mm-hmm. But it was in the ways that you know, things might happen, mm-hmm. and we took it that way, and we thought really that it would help, you know, one way or another, mm-hmm. to get the agreement. Okay. And it would be in the, shall we say, best tradition for the communist side as well as the American side, that whatever you may accept, mm-hmm. just before that, you must show that you accept it in the position of force, not in position of weakness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite understandable for us, you know, those kinds of action. Mm-hmm. But there was a clear, you know, comprehension and understanding that we'll get the agreement, that you have to have the agreement, you know, by the end of that year with the American presidential election.
Great, great.
One way or another. And that was also when I was called back right away to Saigon. Mm-hmm. I had a meeting with the UN, with the National Security Council. Mm-hmm. And the position there that I tried to present to them was that there was no other possible choice for Saigon but to join the U.S. inside the group.
Okay. What was the number one issue in Saigon with the draft and then with the final agreement? What was the number one problem? If you could look back and say, this is what you hated the most about the agreement.
Well, I think we have to go back in time. Mm-hmm. And consider the whole thing in its context. Mm-hmm. After the victory of Richard Nixon in 1968, mm-hmm. we understood that the U.S. must find a way to get itself out of the Vietnam conflict and then you started the so-called Vietnamization process. Mm-hmm. I had the clear impression that President Hill or the Saigon government did not fully realize what was happening with that Vietnamization process.
Did you?
It was something of, you know, come and go of the U.S. troops. So with 500,000 U.S. troops there, mm-hmm. President Nixon can, you know, withdraw 10,000, 20,000. That, you know, did not really worry, you know, President Hill and the Saigon government. And it was done, even many of those withdrawals, which the communists call drop by drop withdrawal. Mm-hmm. It was done even without you know, advance notice to the Saigon government. But I think the Saigon people were still confident that the U.S. government would not abandon them, mm-hmm. one way or another, mm-hmm. you see. And they were very sure that they will continue, you know, to prevail.
Mm-hmm. What did you think?
Well, I also had the same feeling that the U.S. had to de-escalate mm-hmm. their intervention in Vietnam, but they would try very hard to save the Saigon government. So that was the big question mark. Mm-hmm. And that was why I was in the position in 1967, and then particularly in 1970, to follow the evolution of those political aspects, mm-hmm. you know, particularly when I had the opportunity to discuss with the Chinese, and also even before going to Paris mm-hmm. in 1968, by the end of 68, in Vietnam through the news and contacts with my relatives on the other side. Mm-hmm. I must honestly say that at that time it was out of the question that the Saigon government would be overthrown, that some form of government in Saigon would mm-hmm. prevail. Mm-hmm. But then there was a need, of course, to find a formula by which the U.S. could de-escalate its intervention and at the same time permit the Saigon government to survive. Mm-hmm. So that was a very difficult question. And so in that point in time, you had that problem. That is to say, on the one side, Hanoi demand the elimination, complete elimination of the anti-communist Saigon government. On the other hand, I tried to explain, you know, during those contacts, that you are completely, you know, illogical with yourself, accepting to sit down at the negotiating table and demanding that your interlocutor drop dead. Mm-hmm. So that was irrefutable. And I saw a change, you know, in attitude on the other side. Not that because they willingly accepted that point,
right,
but in the context in time, mm-hmm. by 1969 and then particularly by 1970, mm-hmm. You had the beginning of the new chessboard on the international scene, and I think that Beijing as well as Moscow saw it coming too, and they were a little bit, you know, colder in their backing of Hanoi's position, asking for the elimination of the Saigon government mm-hmm. right at the conference table, and some form of Saigon government should be maintained. But then the Hanoi people continue to insist mm-hmm. that the so-called warmongering Saigon leaders should be eliminated, although they no longer demanded, you know, the elimination of the Saigon regime. But then they will try to empty, you know, as much as possible that Saigon regime and then replace it mm-hmm. by their own people. Mm-hmm. So that was very clear to us. But that was a position which was much more defendable on their part than the position asking for the overthrow or the elimination of the Saigon government, per se.
Right. Right.
So that was how things evolved, mm-hmm. you know, and progressed, particularly in 1970. And I reported that mm-hmm. To Thieu right away. There's the beginning of a shift there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you must give credit to the Hanoi people at that time, you know, and Ho Chi Minh were still alive, that they had to be much more, you know, reasonable, you know, in their demands.
Right.
And I must mention here also that through the relatives in Vietnam, I also got the message that they had a meeting, you know, with Ho Chi Minh in Hanoi. Those who came from the south in the 1940s mm-hmm. joined the Viet Minh ranks.
Mm-hmm.
And they were told, as reported to me, by Ho Chi Minh that one day if they return to the south,
mm-hmm.
they should try to maintain the autonomy economically and socially of the Vietnamese in the south, because Ho Chi Minh recognized that there were lots of assets accumulated mm-hmm. there, and the dynamic or entrepreneurial, you know, qualities
mm-hmm.
of the Vietnamese in the south should be an asset, you know,
right.
for the development of the home country. Which then, when I went to Paris in 1969, and then particularly in 1970, when trying to defend, you know, the interests of the Vietnamese in the south, I did put out that idea very forcefully. That is to say, one Vietnam, two system. And you must, you know, if it were possible at that time for Ho Chi Minh and those guys in Hanoi to pursue that line, I'm sure that some kind of accommodation could be found by everybody. But I think that was the idea, and which it was an idea which was not shared much by the other people in Hanoi,
mm-hmm.
particularly Le Duc Tho or Le Duẩn or the others.
Mm-hmm.
But those relatives continued to maintain that they were instructed to do that as early as 1968.
Mm. Do you want to comment any more on your contacts with the Chinese?
Yes, and then, you know, as I said, by 1970,
mm-hmm.
each time that I saw those that person,
mm-hmm.
He tried to imply that there are changes coming. Then eventually in 1971, you had big changes with, you know, all the success of Henry Kissinger to establish contacts with Sun Quy and Le Duc Tho
mm-hmm.
and begin the secret talks,
mm-hmm.
and then for him also to launch the trip to China mm-hmm. and to Moscow and so on. So that was the crucial time. It was a big change at that
mm-hmm.
time, you
mm-hmm.
see. Although it did not appear much, but there was, you know, very substantial move on the part of all parties involved. And that was why I think we had also Operation The Way Canyon,
mm-hmm.
that is Lam Sơn 719.
Mm-hmm.
I think President Nixon very honestly tried to demonstrate that his Vietnamization policy was a big success.
Mm-hmm.
And only yesterday I talked to Jean Wayne, you remember very well. I said, well, our chairman of Grand Chief of Staff, John Carbon Dean, just after the operation Lam Sơn 719, was sent to have a rest of a couple of weeks in Paris with me, and told me at that time that he didn't know very much about that operation, even as chairman of Grand Chief of Staff of the Army. And the whole operation was put in the hands of General Wang Xuân Lam. And General Wayne and I yesterday said that General Wang Xuân Lam, the commander of officer of High Corps, was not the brightest of the Saigon generals. Of course, everybody knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And all the tactical, operational planning and moves were, you know, very badly conceived and organized, and it was a big fiasco. Mm-hmm. And I, at that time, already, I told the incumbent being that as far as the negotiations were concerned, Lamsung 719 was very decisive, because it broke, you know, completely the back of the Arvin, and that it put Thieu in a much, you know, weaker position.
Yes.
And that was how that he was made eventually to accept a number of concessions that he wouldn't have done otherwise. And it was also at that time that the Master Bunker pressured him so much with the Dr. Kissinger behind, that Thieu should try and find ways to, you know, accommodate the demands of Hanoi. And that's the reason why Thieu, who was a very careful man, came to say to Master Bunker, almost off the record, that he would be willing to resign, you know, before having a kind of political solution in Saigon, in South Vietnam. But then Dr. Kissinger jumped on that right away. Did not even inform anybody and passed the message to Lady Thieu. And then Thieu, of course, got into quite a difficult position there. He was willing to make a public declaration, which would be very bad for the Arvin. But he would be able to present it in such a way, you see. And at that time, he was willing to make that declaration. First to step down, which would be, you know, personal sacrifice on his part, which would enhance his even political stand. But he would not do that by himself, giving the impression that he was, you know, doing it under pressure. But he thought that he would do it together with President Nixon, as, you know, close cooperation between the allies to find a peaceful solution to the conflict, and that saying such a thing with President Nixon by his side was no problem. But Dr. Kissinger played it another way.
It seems that the Saigon government was trying, and you can comment on this directly, was trying to survive, obviously, but in the face of an ally who was working to obtain peace with honor and get out, working with an ally that is conducting secret negotiations and bypassing protocol, at the same time dealing with the PRC and their influence on Hanoi, that, as you say, there were changes happening in Beijing and that their influence on Hanoi was changing as well. It almost seems like a completely no-win situation for the government you represented. I mean, you accept some concessions and some things you get changed, but in the end, the Americans leave and Saigon is left to stand on its own, and you're dealing with these people that you've been negotiating with for five years, and it seems like almost everything was disingenuous, that Saigon was fighting against this huge brick wall. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, you can put it that way, but I think there's another way to put it.
Okay.
That is to say, there's nothing really to agree or disagree between the Vietnamese.
Because of the negotiations between the Americans and the North Vietnamese.
And the North Vietnamese.
Right.
See? And then, if you put your foot down, you know, by the end of the day, I think that there was not really a big war, a big dispute between Vietnamese at all. Okay? And it would be very difficult, you know, to think that without the Americans in Vietnam, how would the Saigon government survive?
Mm-hmm.
And when we come to that point in time, in 1970-71,
mm-hmm.
I think that it was the general feeling by even the big powers, you know, the Soviet Union, the PRC, and the United States, that everybody had enough of the Vietnam War. We are not going to find a solution, but at least let's bring it to a lower level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was accepted by everybody,
mm-hmm.
that you have to de-escalate,
mm-hmm.
in the interest of everybody, except Hanoi, of course.
Right, right.
But Hanoi had no other choice, no other choice, you see. And that's why at that time in Hanoi, you had, you know, press articles from the Nhân Dân newspaper of mm-hmm. the Vietnam Communist Party,
mm-hmm. often,
and the Quân Đội Nhân Dân, the army newspaper,
mm-hmm.
that they were betrayed by the Soviet Union and by the PRC, you see, mm-hmm. things like that. And so it was necessary for Hanoi to come up with something. And they started with a win-win situation to begin with. That is to say, they just asked for the U.S. to withdraw.
Right.
And the U.S. would be too happy to withdraw. The problem is for the Saigon government to survive. Okay? And then they take the position, whether the Saigon government survive or not, it's not of your business. Okay?
Right.
It's a matter between the Vietnamese.
Right.
Let them decide. Okay? And to that we cannot say anything. Okay? What we can say is that you launch an armed aggression, you know, by North Vietnam against South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't ring the bell at all. That didn't ring the bell at all in the Vietnamese people. That's right. You see, North Vietnam addressing South Vietnam, it didn't ring the bell for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe through international law, you know, and things like that,
mm-hmm.
you can claim that there's an aggression from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. And you always, you know, take the position that you have two Vietnams. Why Ho Chi Minh took the position only one Vietnam? So to begin with, you have no field to play with. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you're left alone with the North enemies. See? The second thing is, in my opinion, after 30 years,
mm-hmm.
it was, I think, psychological. I think that many of those people in Saigon, they were willing to put up a fight against Ho Chi Minh, you know, in the Vietnam Communist Party. As long as the US, the Americans were there by their side. That is to say, they had a valid reason to fight for freedom and democracy,
mm-hmm.
and be an outpost of the free world.
Mm-hmm.
But without the Americans, they have no reason to be an outpost of the free world. Really? And it came back to the problem of having a fight between brothers. That was very difficult to explain to your family, to your compatriot, and that you have a fight, you know, between brothers. And that is, that was the, I think, the decisive element factor in that Vietnam conflict. That is, as soon as the U.S. government made it clear that it did not have anything anymore to do there,
mm-hmm.
the people in Saigon lost interest in the fight. And the fight against communism, you know, without the Americans, didn't make sense to them.
But that's not what they said publicly.
Oh yeah, sure. For the Saigon government.
Right.
But for the ordinary people in the street, is something completely different.
But again, we've talked about this before. How relevant were the people on the street?
They they were as relevant as the, you know, the feeling to have the end of the conflict.
Right.
They were not much interested with that side of the communists or the anti-communists. But the thing is, as long as, you know, it was possible to find a way out and put this stop to the killing, they would go along with it. That was it. And so, I think that was also, in the end, the kind of thinking that President Hill had. If there were a slight possibility for the U.S. to continue its intervention in that Vietnam conflict, he would try very hard to continue, you know, with the Arvid and with the Saigon government. But the only thing left to President Hill was just a promise by President Nixon and by Dr. Kissinger that should the Hanoi break the terms of the Paris Agreement, that the U.S. would, you know, intervene, but then at that time only from the air.
Right.
And come to what we now know to be the stalemate option by Henry Kissinger. And the Saigon government will continue to linger on like that with that umbrella from the B-52.
But the American public and the American government weren't willing to provide that umbrella for, you know, 10 more years or 15 more years or as long as it would take to protect Saigon.
Can we...
That's the perception. Anyway.
Can we say that President Nixon and Dr. Kissinger were also, you know, honest
right.
in thinking that the U.S. government could do that? But of course, the U.S. government couldn't do that because of Watergate and other things. But there was also another aspect of that problem. That is the the willingness of the U.S. government, you know, to really save that Saigon government, that is in the, its characteristics of anti-communist and so on, and to change it something to a non-communist government instead of anti-communist. I don't think that President Nixon were very attracted by that way. But probably Dr. Kissinger, you know, would say that it's fair enough, you know, that the Saigon government should be a non-communist instead of anti-communist. And what really worried me and many people at that time was, why did not President Nixon and Dr. Kissinger submit the Paris Agreement to Congress? That's one thing. And then take the firm commitment to uphold that if the terms of Paris Agreement wouldn't be honored or observed by the Hanoi government. Another aspect we were also worried about was that the so-called international community was not in the deal at all. Although we had the International Acts, the International Conference, with the presence of Secretary General Ko Wan Dai of the United Nations, but he was just there as an observer, didn't even have the right to say anything. And he was not put, the Paris Agreement was not officially presented to the National Security Council of the United Nations. Nobody had any obligation to do anything. And so, why?
What do you think? Was the United States disingenuous in that sense?
Did President Nixon have the time to do all these things if he really wanted to. I was overcome by all the events.
Mm-hmm.
See, but I'm sure that Dr. Kishore must have taught those aspects.
Of course,
he didn't know anything about it. Probably that was also his belief that the agreement would not be respected at all. And he did not believe that the Hanoi government would give up the fight to dominate the rest of the south of Vietnam, the rest of the country. And I had it was not with great joy that Saigon signed the Paris Agreement. And I think in the end, President Hill put his trust in the work of President Nixon. That was all. It was nothing else. It was rather sad.
I was going to ask you, what was the mood that day when it was signed?
To begin with, President Hill played down completely in Saigon. It was no big deal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember, it was a very big festivity in Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that interested them was Article 1, that the fundamental rights of the Vietnamese people. And that was the most important clause or article of the whole agreement for the Hanoi government. All the other things are just blah, blah, blah.
You said it was with sadness that the Saigon side signed it.
Yes, reluctantly. I think that everybody had the impression that Saigon was almost forced to sign it. But that was the best deal that you could have. There was nothing else you can do.
What did you do? Did you stay in Paris for a while, or did you immediately go back to Saigon?
Well, I was back in Saigon the day they signed officially the thing, but I went back to Paris to participate in the international conference.
Mm-hmm.
And then right afterwards, we had to prepare ourselves for the second phase of the Paris talks according to the terms of the Paris Agreement, that mm-hmm. is to start the conference between the two Saigonese parties mm-hmm. to resolve the political problems.
Mm-hmm.
See, and then I think we started in April or something, to try and arrange make the arrangements with the French government. And then eventually we decided, and they offered a kind of a small castle, chateau, at La Saint-Cloud. I think it was built by King Louis something for his mistress, Madame mm-hmm. de Pompadour, to stay there. And we started the lessons and programs.
What was your role in those negotiations?
Well, I maintained the continuity with the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And then since they tried to put it at the level of Deputy Prime Minister, we had Dr. Nguyen Du Vinh mm-hmm. came to be the head of the delegation. And on the other side, we had Nguyen Van Hill was supposed to be the counterpart in the provisional government of the Republic of South Vietnam of Madam Binh. Dr. Vien lasted about a month, went home, and passed the buck to me for the rest of the period until the end. That was April 1975. It went on and off and was suspended there because there was nothing much to say.
What was there to say? How could this...
Well, we tried to carry out the provisions of the Paris Agreement, mm-hmm. that is to say how to get the National Reconciliation and Council,
mm-hmm.
which at the beginning in the original draft of October 72 it was in Vietnamese labeled as the government structure to supersede the Saigon government to organize elections and so on. And then when President Hill saw the Vietnamese version he insists that that it should be a kind of administrative organ, not the kind of coalition government, but in substance if it was intended to be a kind of coalition government. Although Dr. Kissinger yes, who are my only gods of the earth, that it was not a coalition government, but that was just a game of words. And in fact, the Paris Agreement, in substance, didn't pay attention, did not give much, concern on the survival of the sovereign government. It was a way to accommodate everybody, and it's up to those people in Saigon to survive by themselves.
Do you think the United States achieved peace with honor?
The question would be better put: did the American people feel dishonor after the Paris Agreement? Some of them did, but I think we must give credit to Dr. Kissinger. The large majority of the American people felt relief, and then, the Paris Agreement was a way out, and the Paris Agreement by itself was not a dishonor. I don't think it
was. I'm sorry.
Was not a dishonor. That is, honor was maintained. Others said by the skin of your teeth, but it was maintained. But I think the dishonor came with the fall of Saigon, rather. It was a very bad, as the French say, the last 15 minutes that we had to go through. That was bad.
Why did you return?
Well, I returned because there was nothing left to do to begin with. And then my own parents were there. I felt that I had to be by their side. And I also felt, I must say this, it sounds a bit corny, but I felt responsible for the tragedy. And I wouldn't be able to just sit in Paris and watch. It was not possible. So I couldn't bring myself to do it.
Was it a difficult decision?
No, it was not really a difficult decision.
Did it surprise your colleagues?
Yes, it surprised a lot. And as I said, even a few days ago to David Anderson, because he rushed to my office and said, "Fong, don't go back. The whole thing's collapsing," and so on. And he even offered, his feelings for the bad situation. But I don't regret it. Not at all.
You don't regret it, even though you spent 5 years in prison in Norfolk.
You know, when you think in terms of loss, hardship, and so on, it wouldn't make much difference whether you're locked up in a prison or stay outside, because the people outside also have very hard time. Very, very hard time. And in many ways, for example, when we were in the Hatay prison camp, we observed very well that in many things we were much more privileged than the villagers outside. We had our toothpaste, our soap, we had our ration of sugar, things like that, that the villagers didn't have at all. And we were given 15 kilos of cereal, supposed to be rice or flour of some sort, wheat, and the ordinary people outside the village only had 9 kilos. Because we were supposed to do hard work, we were counted 15 kilos, which we never had in full, because we got lost on the way and arrived at the kitchen, so you end up with about 10 kilos a month. But even it was better than the ordinary people in the village. and should complain.
Did you have any hope for South Vietnam when you began the negotiations with the North Vietnamese and carried through stopping and starting? And then when he finally returned to Saigon, how much hope did you have for...
I had great hope by 1970s, 1971. Because I thought that, you know, through the private channels that I was able to have and was given to me, mm-hmm. I didn't really seek those channels, but mm-hmm. they were offered to me. And I came up with a number of suggestions, mm-hmm. which were received quite, you know, with understanding. that would be the word that I would use, you see. And from the probing that I had of other quarters, they would go along, you know, with the kind of suggestions I had. I tried to take the position or the attitude that, you know, we should not quarrel about the political aspects. We will never, you know, get out of that kind of quarrel. But we should try to show and to deal with problems about the everyday life of the people. That is, the economic and the social aspects of the problem. And I said, these aspects will resolve the political problems in the long run. But I don't think that you can, you know, improve the lot of the people, both in the north and the south of Vietnam, by political formulas, you see. That is, to me, something you know, very artificial. Mm-hmm. But to create or generate conditions and abilities for the people themselves to show that they can do it by themselves. Mm-hmm. And that was why I think I maintain that position till the end, and it was not dismissed even after the death of Ho Chi Minh. Nobody said that they were not, you know, acceptable ideas or suggestions or proposals. But we were taken over by you know, what Lady Choa managed to make Dr. Kissinger do.
What are the suggestions that you have that were understandably received, as you said?
That is the economic.
Economic. You know,
allow the people both north and south to try and get together and, you know, go into business.
Two Vietnams or one Vietnam?
That was the thing which was difficult. Mm-hmm. But I must tell you honestly, you know, from the depth of my soul, that in the last analysis, if it were necessary, and provided they accept the economic formula that I suggested, I would accept a federation, even under the Hanoi government. But of course, there would be some autonomy. Mm-hmm. In the south, in order to make the economic solution prevail. Mm-hmm. But I have thought a lot about that, and I said that even if we agree to a kind of a federation and be a little bit less, you know, than the Hanoi government, it wouldn't kill you. And besides, they are just words. But the thing was much more difficult is to have the economic means backing, you know, from the West or from Europeans and so on, to make the South prevail. And I was, you know, more than convinced at that time that in that kind of competition, we in the South will win, because they were completely flat economically, and they had any experience, mm-hmm. you know, in those things. Mm-hmm. we could have overcome them economically and make them accept our ways of life little by little, but we would be, you know, we would succeed to make them accept our ways of life.
Did the Korean...
That's what I said to Ban Min once, yeah, officially at the conference there.
Officially?
Officially.
What did she say?
You know, what you are, your objective, what you are... Probably we get it from the minutes, if you have the Paris Peace Talks and have a look at them. At one time during the discussion part, after reading the sacred speeches, you know, and I said to Madam Nguyen once, I said, what you are trying to do, see, you are depriving the Vietnamese people of the opportunities to improve, you know, economically and so on and so forth, because the communist regimes have never succeeded economically anywhere.
Right.
And I also mentioned, if I remember correctly, that if they manage to achieve the objective, they would create a disequilibrium in the area. And I must mention also that during the years 1970-71, I had a big quarrel with the French at the foreign ministry, you know, because at that time I tried to make them explain to me what Jean de Gaulle meant by neutralizing the whole area, that is the Indochina Peninsula, an area of neutrality. And that went parallel to my idea too, the kind of neutrality. But I said my neutrality, if I may say so, is a bit more dynamic, you know, because it's mainly economic and social. Why their neutrality was based more political and military aspects. And I said, well, both North and South Vietnam had different military alliances. How could they be neutral, you see? And they had to go back, I think, to Jean de Gaulle to clarify what they meant by neutrality. And I had, you know, weeks of discussions with the French. That was the time of Michel Debray, who was the foreign minister of France at that time. But I had dealings with Henri Beau, who was responsible for the China area, and then with Robert Maurice, who was the director at the Quai d'Orsay for the whole Asia-Pacific region. And they were also very vague in their idea of neutrality too. Since, you know, you have the Soviet Union in the north and the Americans in the south, what kind of neutrality do you have? And the only answer that they gave me in the end, because I want to try and match it with my ideas there, they said, well, not the neutrality in the regime, political regime, see, but neutrality in your action. That is splitting hair. That's what I said to them, splitting hair. How can you be neutral in your action and not in, you know, substance in the kind of political regime you have? But that was the main idea in 1970-71. That we could have come to some kind of an understanding, and that would, you know, also mean that the U.S. Military intervention would cease completely.
Right.
But then it would be replaced by, you know, the U.S. and other Western countries, capitalist countries, to move in on the economic.
Take the guns out, add the butter.
That's it.
More butter.
That's it.
So, what was Madame Ben's reaction when you said this?
She said that I was saying nonsense. That's the term she used in Vietnamese.
What did you say?
We all laughed because she did not find anything better than say. That was the habit of Madame Bin when she was, you know, short of a response. She would say, "You are saying nonsense." The only thing is the national independence and sovereignty and, you know, U.S. aggression and things like that. If not, then it's nonsense.
Did you find her more robotic in lacking intellectually?
Completely. Completely, you know. Uh-huh. Completely. And she had never had any, you know, imagination at all.
Who at the conference demonstrated the most intellectual acuity?
Sun Tui. Yeah. He was a kind of poet too. He's a writer, poet. Mm-hmm. So he tried to show, you know, some kind of intellectual capability. While Le Duc Thong said very little, never said anything publicly or officially, because that was it.
Okay.
All right.
This is Richard Verona. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Ambassador Fong. It is January 10th, 2003 at 9:45 a.m. and we're in Lubbock, Texas again at the Special Collections Library interview room. Ambassador Fong, we left off last time discussing the very end of the Paris Agreements, your subsequent meetings with your Vietnamese counterparts, and then returning to Saigon. I'd like to ask you a few questions about what happened in 1975, personally with your family. How much contact did you have while you were in Paris and then leading up to the end, 73, 74, 75, how much contact did you have with your uncles in Hanoi and with the people in the north, your family members?
Well, the information, mm-hmm, that were sent to me through those channels from the relatives on the other side, mm-hmm, they came very regularly. But being in Paris, mm-hmm, after the signing of the Paris Agreement, communication were much freer, of course, than, mm-hmm, before, mm-hmm, the signing of the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. But then, with the worsening of the situation, mm-hmm, in Vietnam, in South Vietnam itself, and then in the United States with the Watergate scandal and so on, it was very clear to us that the situation deteriorated very fast. And so, by the beginning of 1975, and with the way that President Thieu dealt with the situation, which then made it even worse, you know, mm-hmm, that is from the attacks by the communist troops in Phước Long province, and then what happened in the highlands in Pleiku, Kon Tum, and then in the central Vietnam, mm-hmm, moving down to Saigon. So it was very clear that the whole thing was collapsing very fast. Mm-hmm. But besides the information that we got from the Vietnamese, we also got lots of intelligence information also from the French. Mm-hmm. Who were very willing to share those things. Mm-hmm. And we tried very hard, of course, and I went to Washington, D.C. by the end of 73, as you know, mm-hmm, to get some support from the Democrats. And then I did a tour in the Middle East also to get support from the Arab friends, mm-hmm, that I had there. But it was very clear that by the beginning of 1975, the whole thing was collapsing very fast because of all kinds of reasons. And by mid-April 1975, I also went to Rome because I had a number of meetings with officials in Vatican in order to try and understand better the contacts that they had with the NLF, mm-hmm, by the Buddhist group, mm-hmm, because the priests in the Saigon were also very active, pushing for Big Minh to take over. Mm-hmm. And it was the stand of the Vatican to move into some kind of that coalition. Mm-hmm. That even at the time of President Johnson, there was a there were attempts to get the NNF and Saigon together somehow.
With whom did you meet with at the Vatican City?
Oh, that was the what they call the general of the Jesuits. Mm-hmm. And then he brought along who was an Irish and I knew him a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And he gathered a number of people who were involved with the Vietnam issue. So, well, I did not find much from them, just that the desire to have some kind of compromise and conciliation. So that was very clear that by mid-April, on the one hand, you have a very hard pressure, including the United States, and also persuasion from the French government for Thieu to pass over to General Viet Minh. And the other aspect that I was very concerned with was the position, the line of action taken by Thieu. That is to say, his refusal to put up a fight. And the French military expert said it is catastrophic. You know, if you don't put that, it will mean that it will snowball down very fast to Saigon. Mm-hmm. And it was also very clear that President Ford would not give the slightest indication that the U.S. Will stand by the Saigon government. And so that was the green light. Although we knew that Dr. Kissinger tried, but they were very feeble efforts to get the international community together. He suggested to have some meetings in Geneva or anywhere else in order to get, you know, the Hanoi government mm-hmm. to somehow stick to the terms of the Paris Agreement, mm-hmm. To have a ceasefire and to go into a coalition government and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Provided Thieu would resign. So Ambassador Martin in Saigon pressed very hard on Thieu to pass over the buck to Viet Minh. But of course, Thieu waited and waited for an American intervention, militarily, massive, in order to put a check to the attempts of the North Vietnamese troops. Mm-hmm. Which he permitted to happen. That is to say, he didn't put up any resistance whatsoever, claiming that he was recruiting his troops in order to defend the lower part of South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so that was not much of an argument. And I had to go on the French TV and radio to explain that recruitment of Thieu's troops.
Was that difficult for you to do?
It was really difficult.
Because you didn't believe that it was effective?
And nobody believed in it. And the French intelligence forces also then, by I would say by the 20th of April, they already informed us that according to their assessment, you would have at least 15 divisions, you know, around Saigon in a very short time. And from my channel, I was made to understand that the offensive, the attack against Saigon would happen around the 25th or 26th of April, you see. That was just a few days after my arrival, return back to Saigon.
If you know, what were the French channels? I mean, how did they get their intelligence?
Well, I had a number of former French superior officers, mm-hmm. even at the general ranks, mm-hmm. but many of them were just, you know, colonels and so on, who followed very closely, you know, with the intelligence they received. And they share with us and those intelligence, probably in view of putting more pressure, you know, on the Saigon government to compromise with the NLF. Mm-hmm. And that was their intention. Mm-hmm. And at one time, one of them even told me that the way that the communist troops would attack Saigon was massive shelling of the city before they move in. Mm-hmm. And they said that it's not impossible that they have probably about 20,000 rounds of heavy artillery on Saigon per day. That is from the sources that they have collected, that those shells were already gathered all around Saigon. And the main headquarters to direct that heavy shelling on Saigon is around the Phu Chi area.
Almost like another.
And that is what I was made to understand, that right. the attack would be done on the 26th, uh-huh. you see. And I return on the 24th, 25th. That is just one day before.
Right.
But it was also made to understand that the President Ford and the Kissinger managed to persuade Brezhnev to intervene with the Hanoi people to give the Americans 4 days to get out, because it was claimed that it would be very embarrassing for Hanoi to have a number of American prisoners.
Right.
So it was accepted, you know, by the Hanoi people, that sufficient time would be given mm-hmm. For them to get out mm-hmm. before the Hanoi troops move into Saigon. Mm-hmm. And then, when I left Paris, there was also the understanding that the Americans could not get out, you know, completely within those 4 days.
Right.
And the French were trying to convince the Hanoi people to give an additional 4 days too, you know, for mm-hmm. the U.S. to move out. Mm-hmm. So that is to say, that would be for the 4th or the 5th of May, you see. But when I left Paris, the last information I got was that Hanoi was not willing to come another additional 4 days. So that is what happened when I came back to Saigon, and from the airport went to see President Hung, who took over from President Thieu on the 21st.
Mm-hmm. Was the French intelligence your main source of intelligence?
Yes.
Okay.
Very much. Yes.
Did you have any other sources that you can speak of?
Oh, the Vietnamese community there. And many of them, of course, had relations with my uncles in Hanoi. Mm-hmm. And also from Saigon, as you know, those relatives very often visited my parents. Mm-hmm. And but these were information of a general nature, which also helped me to sense the mood, you
right.
know, on the other side.
Right. How many times did you actually get to meet with your relatives from the other side during the war, or
while I was in Saigon? Mm-hmm. But while I was in Paris, then I got those news sent to me.
Okay.
And it was also known that from Saigon, President Thieu and Mr. Nha, mm-hmm. Through their channels, also managed to get information about the meetings between Dr. Kissinger and Mr. Lédicteau. Although at that time Ambassador Bunker, who didn't know at the very beginning that there were those contacts, private contacts between Dr. Kissinger and the North Vietnamese. But of course later on, Ambassador Bunker was informed by Dr. Kissinger of those secret talks. Mm-hmm. But in Saigon, they were also able to get information, you know, through their own channels, because they disposed of many possibilities and means. Mm-hmm. But we in Paris Ambassador Lam and I, we also got our channels, mm-hmm. and we also sent back that those information to Saigon to President Thieu. Mm-hmm. And as you know, at one time, Ambassador Lam concentrated his efforts on the Vietnamese community in Paris, and I, thanks to the possibilities given to me by the Burmese diplomats and others in Paris, I was also able to establish a kind of my network with a number of other governments who were not very sympathetic to the Saigon government or to the American intervention in Vietnam. But that was the possibility given to me, and I reported to Thieu right away that those channels were offered to me. Would I pursue? But it was made very clearly that I would do it on a strictly personal basis, not as a representative of the Saigon government, to try and find out whether there were ways to come to some kind of a settlement or a compromise. And that started already in 1970, very much in 71 and 72. And so we were able to you know, try and put the pieces of the puzzle a little bit together. And as it was agreed with President Thieu, I had to play the role of you know, providing at least that kind of option to him in the last resort. And it was made clear to me by President Thieu through the channels I had with him, and that the channel was indicated by President Thieu himself through a joint common friend who was in the CIO in Saigon, that is Central Intelligence Office, the Colonel, Intelligence Colonel, who was the trusted man and channel of President Thieu with me in Paris. He's been there, and I tried to get him to the Oral History. But that was the situation. And by April 20th, 21st, with the last pressure from Ambassador Martin, President Thieu eventually gave up, because he, I think at that time, considered useless to wait for a massive military intervention by the United States. And he fought only from the air. But even then, that would be a kind of a signal, meaningful signal by the United States, that it would not let the RVN collapse under the snowballing advance of the North Vietnamese troops with their Russian tanks. But then it was also made clear to me that President Thieu also tried to maintain those channels and the last option. And I had always, you know, insisted that, you know, should he think that that kind of option should be, you know, open till the end, indications on the part of the Saigon government should also be given that I would be in the position to fully deal and discuss with that kind of channel.
Right.
And that was the very reason why, in, even through his resignation, he asked Trần Văn Hưởng to maintain me in the last government of Saigon in the position of Minister of State in charge of negotiations and head of the delegation in Paris in order to talk with the relatively necessary authority if we were to keep that channel open.
How effective were these channels? I mean, with the advancing troops coming in, was diplomacy even really a realistic option at this point?
Well, there was nothing left.
It's true.
But then, you see, many other governments were also anxious and eager to move in, since it was very clear that the U.S. would not return,
mm-hmm.
you know, wouldn't do anything to save the RVM,
mm-hmm.
Except pushing it even more to a compromise and a coalition with the NLF through Big Ming. That's what they all believe, you know. TU, many of us in the Saigon didn't believe for 1 minute that you could have any kind of compromise with the NLF. To us, the NLF was just unknown. There was no NLF.
Right. Did you tell them this?
Oh, yes.
And their reaction was, what was their reaction to that? You were saying, no, the NLF is Hanoi, and there's really no coalition to be had with the NLF.
Yes.
What was their reaction to that, the other countries?
In the country?
Yeah, the other countries that you were in contact with and the people you were in contact with.
Well, they really believe that Hanoi, you know, would agree to a temporary formula while waiting for the complete takeover, you know, by the Vietnam Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
And the French particularly thought that, you know, it would be possible to have that temporary solution, and we'll see, you know.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there were other countries that wanted to step in and
yes.
fill the vacuum that the United States had left.
Yes.
Which countries were these?
Well, I think it would not be very, you know, proper for me. I'm not at the liberty to
okay.
name them, but I can say that it was understood that the French would take the lead,
okay.
you know, to move in. But there were other countries willing to join the French government to do that, you see.
Uh-huh.
And even those countries were very eager to act very fast, and many of those countries, even in the very last minute, why I returned already in Saigon, contacted our embassies abroad, particularly our embassy in London,
mm-hmm.
to ask for immediate action before it's too late.
And they refused? Or...
No, because there was no response.
Okay, no response.
No response, you know. And I think it was necessary to have some more time.
Are you talking about military intervention?
Or all kinds.
All kinds.
Yes.
Okay.
If it were, you know, desperate, a military action would be necessary as, you know, a way to freeze things, you know, for a very short time in order to
right.
come up to something more lasting.
I suppose the intervention of other countries would make Hanoi pause and say, wait a minute, what, the situation has drastically changed now. There are other countries involved willing to change the situation.
It was clear at that time, I think that the guy, who, or the government who had the real say about it was the USSR.
Okay.
And I had the impression at that time that the U.S. government, Washington, put also lots of hope and trust in the Soviet, that they could try and, you know, find a way
mm-hmm.
somehow to get that coalition
mm-hmm.
in South Vietnam. That was the understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that the people in the Kremlin at that time would take their usual position, that is to say, in a way to give the impression to you Americans that the subject are also, you know, sharing the views of Washington to a certain extent, but it is up to the people in Hanoi to decide
mm-hmm.
their fate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that the people in Kremlin thought very clearly that the Hanoi people were in a position to take over the whole of South Vietnam by force very easily, because Thieu has indicated very clearly since the very beginning of 1975 that he would not put up a fight
mm-hmm.
you know, between those two armies. And the other people or other governments may not like, you know, to have a takeover by Hanoi, and would desperately try in the last minute to have some kind of a temporary even solution to South Vietnam while waiting for better days. And there are lots of people who would not like to have the extension of Soviet influence, even to the south of Vietnam. That was very clear. It was very clear. And to Thieu, right at the, at the signing of the Paris Agreement, he was convinced, rightly or wrongly, he was convinced that it was sell out completely by the Americans to the Soviet. That is to say, in his mind, he thought that Kissinger, who played then China and the Soviet, then in the geopolitical game, would give the whole of Vietnam to the Soviet.
You mentioned too not putting up much of a fight in this last month or so. Could you equate that, his attitude, and basically saying, we're not going to put up a fight? That you said this was made clear between these two armies. Was that the responsibility for the Arvin collapsing so quickly?
This is was very clear.
Okay.
There was no reason why Thieu could not have retaken the lost post in Phật Long. There were small battles. Even Schlesinger, the defense secretary, said there were just small battles, and the communist troops had done that for years. I mean, they just took positions, and then the crack units of the RVM would come back to retake those positions. But this time they were really surprised. You see, Thieu did not order to retake those positions at all. It was a very feeble little skirmishes and so on and so forth. And then when the North Vietnamese tested, mainly to test the U.S., whether the U.S. would move back or not, and they have always traditionally test in the highlands since the French time, colonial time. So they tested them there, you see. And then Thieu, instead of putting up a fight, asked Yen Phu even to withdraw, down to the center of Vietnam along the coastline. And that withdrawal was chaotic, real fiasco on Route 9, you see. And then when the North Vietnamese regular troops started their attacks again, the VMZ and the I Corps region with General Thieu, instead of reinforcing, you see, the units of General Thieu there, he even took out, emptied the men, you see. And so Thieu was faced with a ratio of 1-3 regular divisions. So it was a fiasco too. He had to run away, really.
Was Thieu hoping for a diplomatic solution here?
That is to say, he, again, rightly or wrongly, you see, thought that by that process he would be able to convince the Washington that the situation is dramatic now. You know, you have to do something if you are true to your words that you are going to defend and, you know, guarantee the security of the RVM, as President Nixon said in his letter, and so on and so forth, you see. But then, it was very clear to Thieu, and it was a bad pocket bluff. It was a bad pocket bluff, I'm sure, you see. I'm sure. Because it was not really, I don't think that Thieu really thought, you know, that the US will come back and put up a fight with the RVN. He just wanted to have some kind of a meaningful indication, a sign from Washington that he's not going to give up Saigon that easy. You see? That is to say, you have to compose with the Saigon government, and then big men will permit you to have a kind of coalition, and it was understood by everybody, Beijing and Moscow and so on. But you cannot, you know, overrun them like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the understanding, the basis on which, you know, things went. And so till then, to accept it, to give up in the end on the 21st of April, because it was very clear that even a meaningful small sign or signal by Washington was not even possible.
Was he surprised at that?
I don't think it is a matter of a surprise, but it is, you know, the wearing out of hope. In the very last minute, the man hoped in the very last minute, and it was clear that it was no longer possible.
How did you feel about all that? How was that affecting you?
Well, I was first very, you know, worried about my old parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the first concern that I had. And so, whatever, I wanted to be by their side. And the second thing was that maybe I could be helped to the Saigon people, mm-hmm. whoever, whether it was Hung or Big Minh, that mm-hmm. didn't matter at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other side, you know, did not worry very much who would be in the Saigon. And the worse they are, the better. They even mentioned to me, you know, sometime before that even Bao Dai would be the very good, you know, candidate to have the Saigon government in the coalition with them.
What about you?
Oh no, I was too young to begin with, and then I played rather the role of you know, trying to find out areas of possible understanding and agreement rather than to play any role.
Okay.
Yeah. But it was clear that they would like to have my contributions.
Okay.
It was not necessary for me to play any public role. But I did not say that I would refuse if it was necessary.
But you knew through your contacts that they wanted you to be a part of whatever,
yes.
that Hanoi wanted you to be part of whatever solution was going to happen.
Did and there was even a meeting after my return to Saigon, and I saw President He.
Mm-hmm.
There was a meeting called by Chen Dong, Phan Van Dong, by Mr. Nguyen Xuân Oanh, Jack Owen.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the only two who were really, could say, Saigon people with me in the meeting. And all the others were Viet Cong.
Where did the meeting take place?
Right beside the Independence Palace, about a 1 minute walk. It was in a house provided by Jean Thumang Dong.
Mm-hmm.
And he really believed where he could play a role, and with Jack Owen and Su Wan, we could he could have you know, dialogue with the other side,
mm-hmm.
Much better than Big Minh.
Mm-hmm.
But the NLF, they play home the people, and it was just you know, some window dressing, waiting for the North Vietnamese troops to come.
Did those Viet Cong leaders, did they think they would have a place in the future government?
Oh yes, very much.
But yeah, that was not.
They're still alive now in Saigon. And then later on, after my return from re-education in prison, I regularly met with them. And they were, of course, very, you know, disillusioned.
Right.
Right. Very quick afterwards.
Your parents, you mentioned, you know, this was your primary reason of returning, to make sure they were okay. And when you were in Saigon, you said you wanted to make sure that they were okay and taken care of. Weren't they going to be protected because you had relatives of a family in the north, did you feel like they would be more protected than the average citizen?
Oh yes, I'm sure that not great harm would come to them.
Right.
Because they never done anything, you know, politically. I think they were just very simple, ordinary people. Mm-hmm. But I was worried rather, you know, for the stray bullets.
Right.
If there were, you know, what we all expected, really, it was the Battle of Saigon. And arriving from the airport direct to Independence Palace, as you know, the first person that I bumped into was Ambassador Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat there and in the living room talking for some time. He just came out of the meeting with President Hull. And so we begin to talk about the military situation, which mm-hmm. was catastrophic, of course. And I was very concerned about that certain battle of Saigon. And I told Ambassador Martin, you know, what I knew from various sources, including the French intelligence sources,
mm-hmm.
and that the Battle of Saigon was very imminent, and the kind of capabilities that the communist troops had at mm-hmm. that time to launch an attack against Saigon, and he agreed with me completely,
mm-hmm.
and I had the impression too that you know, the U.S. intelligence at that time was not very effective. Was not very effective. They were unable to follow the situation in the islands, then in central Vietnam. They were completely lost. And it was through a very well calculated, you know, counter-espionage action by the communist side to mislead the Americans and Saigon.
Hmm. Why were the Americans so inept at intelligence at this point, do you think?
I have the impression they were disorganized.
Really?
You know, by March, April, they were disorganized. Not because of their bad management, but they were disorganized because the network on which they depended began to crumble, and you know, people began to have certain thoughts,
mm-hmm.
you know, by March, mm-hmm. the beginning of April 1975.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm assuming President Tu felt readily abandoned by not just the United States but by these other countries when you tried to contact them, and contacts were put out and there was no answer. As you said,
the impression I had,
uh-huh.
President Hill put all his hope in the United States. He did not, believe in anybody else, because he did not think that anybody else could help South Vietnam the way he thought should be helped.
Right.
You
know? Right.
That is to maintain some sort of an anti-communist political regime there,
mm-hmm.
and so whatever other options were possible at that time besides the support and the help assistance from the United States, he did not pay much attention, and he thought that instead of selling, you know, the whole of Vietnam to the Soviets,
mm-hmm.
there was only the other possibility is to give it to the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, I think, he thought that the option for the Chinese would be even worse than not having the Americans there.
Mm-hmm.
Because for 1,000 years, the Vietnamese always had that dilemma and tried to get, you know, away from the Chinese influence, and it was also the choice of Ho Chi Minh to go Soviet in order to placate the Chinese.
Right.
Yeah. So that was also the choice given to him.
Okay. You were back in Saigon for just a few days before the collapse. Can you describe the atmosphere around the presidential palace and inside the presidential palace at that time?
Well, the first impression at the airport mm-hmm. was that people were trying to get out. Mm-hmm. Thousands and thousands of people. And then arriving at the palace, I saw that it was the beginning of, let go. Most of the people in the government were gone. And I had the impression that Aung Hương was left almost by himself there.
Right.
And then I ran into Jean Cavan Viem, who was the chairman of Joint Chief of Staff, and then also Jean Thong Van Dong, who was with me in the same government as Defense Minister. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get many encouragement from those two. And it was very imminent that President Hương had to transfer the so-called presidential powers to Big Min. Mm-hmm. That was the thing. Mm-hmm. President Thieu refused to do that because he didn't believe in Big Min. And second, he always claimed it would be unconstitutional for him to do that. The only thing is to resign in favor of his vice president. And Aung Hương was already 72 at that time. Not in very good shape, bad health, and almost couldn't read anything anymore with his bad eyesight. Mm. And of course, he was made to understand by the U.S. Ambassador and also very much by the French ambassador, mm-hmm. Marion, that he should, as soon as possible, pass his powers to Big Min. And he also claimed that it would be very unconstitutional. And to do that, and the only thing is for him to, surrender his powers to the National Assembly and the Senate, mm-hmm. join Ngli, and it is up to them to designate, someone. He tried to maintain, very artificial things at that time, mm-hmm. that is to say to remain president because he claimed to be the elected, president mm-hmm. of the RVM, mm-hmm. and he was prepared to issue a decree to say that Big Min would have total power, mm-hmm. authority, mm-hmm. As prime minister to act in the name of the president and so on. But of course, Big Min refused that.
Right.
And the NLF also passed a message that that's not what we want, And it was the collapse of the legitimacy of the constitutional government of the Republic of Vietnam that they were after. That also explained why Big Min had to remove the emblem of the RVM and replace it by the lotus flower, which was no emblem at all of a country. And that was it.
What was your impression of Big Min?
Oh, Big Min, he had never impressed me in any way, because the man was completely, I would say, almost apolitical too. He was not able to think anything political, and he was just a figurehead used by all kinds of people. He was considered to be more or less the hero to have overthrown President Diem, and that was all. They did not manifest any, political capabilities or any kind of thinking mm-hmm. that could mean anything. But he was the point of rally for the opposition.
Mm-hmm. And what were your interactions with him in those last few days?
I had interactions rather with the lawyer Nguyen Yang Nguyen. Mm-hmm. Who was the vice president of President Dương Văn Minh, of Big Minh, mm-hmm. and lawyer Nguyễn Văn Quyền was at one time president of the Saigon Senate, mm-hmm. very highly respected lawyer, and a friend of our family, of my parents for 50 years, like Hương. Mm-hmm. But he was really, you know, a stern Catholic, very religious man,
mm-hmm.
very religious, very close ties with the Vatican too. And I saw him also after my return from prison in 1980. They were spared of re-education, McMinn and Hume and Roy Yeo-Wing. And he was made responsible by Bittman for the negotiation. So I was, in fact, what he said, his counterpart,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the transitional government.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down with him, of course, and discussed the thing. And he also expressed the necessity for me to join him in the next few days to deal with the other side. But of course, he hardly had 48 hours to do that.
Right.
Yeah. But right. I was at his disposal.
Hmm. So you had very little direct contact with Bickman?
Yes, with Roy Yeo-Wing.
Just through him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because Bickman, he was no use to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And the Prime Minister of Bickman at that time was Mr. Wu Wong Mao,
mm-hmm.
who was at one time the foreign minister of President Yim, and he was in the position, very Buddhist, in the position to tail, and he was made then prime minister by Bickman in the Bickman government with Roy Yeo-Wing as vice president responsible for negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
That was the setup. So I said to Roy Yeo-Wing that I was at his disposal, you know, and I did not even have time to report to him on the various channels open. But I thought that if it were possible to stop or to have a kind of a ceasefire,
mm-hmm.
Standstill,
mm-hmm.
While we talk with Bickman in power, then I would present to Roy Yeo-Wing, you know, the various possibilities of other channels open,
mm-hmm.
to Saigon at that time.
Did you ever, so you never talked to him about that?
No, because after that the North Vietnamese troops arrived.
Right, so you had no time to even do that.
Not at all.
Mm-hmm. How much role did the Vatican play in all of this?
Well, even since 1966-67, there was already a chief in the position of the Vatican towards a coalition government. So they thought that was the only way, and they were, you know, somehow convinced by the NLF people, you know, because the Catholics in the Saigon,
mm-hmm.
had lots of contacts with the many leading political figures in South Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and particularly Roy Yeo-Wing Nguyen Nguyen, who was president of the Saigon Senate and so on,
mm-hmm.
style Catholic. Very kind and very respected man,
mm-hmm.
and I think through people like Roy Yeo-Wing,
mm-hmm.
The Vatican tried to show its position there, that it would go, and in fact the Vatican's position was the American position,
right.
leading eventually some kind of compromise,
mm-hmm.
and that was it. The French really believed that they could play a role in it too.
Mm-hmm. How much reality was the notion of neutrality? If there was a ceasefire, or if there was some kind of pause in a coalition government set up, this has been mentioned in context of the whole thing.
That started, of course, already in 1964-65 with Jean de Gaulle's visit to Phnom Penh,
uh-huh.
when he declared neutrality for the whole zone of Indochina, as Indochina to be a zone of neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
And he was thinking very much at that time of the formula used to resolve the conflict in Laos,
mm-hmm.
in 1962, and again thanks to Ambassador Harriman.
Which failed. This
which I mean.
In Laos.
Yes. And in fact, it was my duty given to me in 1969-1970, particularly in Paris, to try and understand what the French meant by neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to Mr. Pharma Maurice, who was at that time responsible for Vietnam, being the director of Asia Pacific at the Quai d'Orsay, the French Foreign Ministry. And then I also had discussions with the Foreign Minister at that time, Mr. Michel Debray. And of course, they were not in position to explain to me what Jean de Gaulle meant by neutrality for the whole of Indochina, because I told them that, you know, North and South Vietnam had, you know, military alliances, you know, in the position, and it would be very difficult to ask North Vietnam to be neutral. It would be easier to ask South Vietnam to be neutral, but North Vietnam to be neutral would be very difficult since they have a socialist regime.
Right.
And so in the end, I was met to understand by our French friends there that what Jean de Gaulle meant by neutrality for the whole of Indochina was the neutrality in attitude and in action by the belligerents. But they, of course, have their own political regimes, you know, and their whole their alliances, military alliances. So I said that it's very difficult to understand, and the term I used was rather splitting heads, hair in four, as the French say.
That would have meant the whole dream of Ho Chi Minh to unite Vietnam, the notion of a communist Vietnam, that would have tossed that out the window, this idea of neutrality. So that was probably very unacceptable.
Yes. And that is something that we have to really reconsider when we try to understand the Vietnamese conflict. You know, the notion of two Vietnam, North and South, or was it just one Vietnam because the Geneva Accords divided the country at the 17th parallel, being just a temporary line of demarcation to recruit the forces and not politically to divide a country. And so, you know, from the strategy, you know, viewpoint, it was, you know, not very logical to claim that there were de jure to Vietnam.
Right.
And in fact, that was the position of the U.S. government, because the U.N. never recognized the Geneva Accords, you see. And so how then, afterwards, with Ngo Dinh Diem, then the U.S. took the position that there were two legal entities, de jure in Vietnam.
Right.
That was very difficult to help the Vietnamese in South Vietnam to understand.
A de facto division temporarily would have been more acceptable, more realistic to the history of Vietnam. Or the backing away of forces.
Yes. And then the claim by the Saigon government, supported by the U.S. government, that you should, you know, maintain that division was not easily understood by the ordinary people, especially the peasants in the countryside in South Vietnam. So it was difficult to persuade or convince the Vietnamese in South Vietnam that you should maintain two different Vietnams, and that the kind of nationalism that President Diem started to infuse into the Vietnamese in South Vietnam was a kind of nationalism in order to fight another kind of nationalism in the north of Vietnam that could not stand. That could not stand at all.
Do you think it was foolish to almost play against Vietnamese history, that two Vietnams was completely historically unrealistic for the Vietnamese people?
Oh, yes.
Since Vietnam had expanded from the north down to the south over centuries and centuries ago, it had always been one country.
Yes, has always been one country. And even President Diem could not, you know, completely reject it. So on the one hand, he wanted to have recognition for something called the Republic of Vietnam and South Vietnam.
Right.
But on the other hand, he could not refute, you know, the idea that Vietnam is one, the Vietnamese people is one. And that was the formula used by Ho Chi Minh right at the beginning. Vietnam is one and the Vietnamese people is one. You see? And so, but to claim future reunification of Vietnam was in fact, you know, kind of lip service, you know, the declarations by the Saigon government, you know, from 1955 to 1975. So that did not catch on with the Vietnamese people.
Right.
Because in the end, the position taken by the U.S. government was for two Vietnam. So that was the difficulty,
mm-hmm.
you know, in order to get the South Vietnamese
mm-hmm.
to oppose North Vietnam.
What about making North Vietnam one state, South Vietnam one state, in one country, but different states, and then have a coalition government? Was this more practical?
Well, it was suggested even mm-hmm. at the time of President Diem.
Mm-hmm.
So by October 1963,
mm-hmm.
When the U.S. Was very dissatisfied with his performance, and it was revealed
mm-hmm.
that his brother, political advisor Ngô Đình Diệm,
mm-hmm.
Approached, you know, and sent messages to Ho Chi Minh to have some kind of understanding with Ho Chi Minh.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the Marigold project.
Mm-hmm.
I think it went through if I remember correctly, it went through the Italian ambassador and through the ICCI
mm-hmm.
Members.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, since President Diem and Mr. New saw the U.S. would, you know, jettison them,
mm-hmm.
They were prepared to join Ho Chi Minh in a kind of federation, provided Ho Chi Minh accepted an autonomy,
mm-hmm.
you know, in South Vietnam.
This is Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Ambassador Phong. It's Monday, January 13th, 2003. Sir, we were talking about the last days of the Saigon government in 1975 in April. I wonder if you could just walk us through. You returned and you had 5 days before the fall of the country. If you could just walk us through those 5 days, kind of what you did each day and your feeling about what was happening.
Well, I can begin with from the moment I landed in Saigon,
mm-hmm.
returning from Paris, and then I went directly to Independence Palace because President Hu was expecting me there.
Did they have a car waiting?
Oh yes, with bodyguards and everything. And each time I returned to Saigon, it was the same protocol.
Was Tan Son Nhut, was it very busy?
Do you remember? Oh yes, it was a big crowd there. You have a very long line queuing outside the airport along the roadside.
Mm-hmm.
I would say thousands of people
mm-hmm.
are waiting to get in to the airport and get on the planes, because the planes were, you know, taking off that
mm-hmm.
To take people out, thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, those who had their papers and their seats on the planes, but many of them tried to get on the planes at that time. So I was taken to Independence Palace. It was about 50 minutes drive from the airport. And
15.
It was very quiet.
Yes.
And that was by 5, 6 p.m. When I arrived there, the very first person I met while on my way into President Hearn's office was the U.S. Ambassador, Graham Martin, who was getting out
mm-hmm.
of President Hearn's office. And so we went into the living room there, kind of a waiting room there. We sat down and we talked. And of course, I just saw him a few weeks before when he had returned to Washington, D.C., trying to plea for Saigon again.
Mm-hmm.
And on his way back to Saigon, he went through Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw him there just a few weeks before. And of course, we knew at that time that the situation was deteriorating very fast. Then during that discussion, I tried to impress him that as far as I was able to figure it out, the military situation was catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
And what worried me very much was to avoid what I call the Battle of Saigon,
mm-hmm.
the so-called bloodbath which would entail from that battle.
Mm-hmm.
And Ambassador Martin was completely in agreement with me that the situation became completely hopeless. The best thing he tried to impress me was for the President Hu to turn over his presidential powers to Big Minh.
Mm-hmm.
And from the conversation that I couldn't understand, it confirmed the general impression that we all had that probably Big Minh could find a kind of solution with the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And other side would mean the NLF. And so it was on that note that the Ambassador Martin tried to explain to me that there is some, shall we say, possibility if Big Minh were in charge. And so after that he left, and then I met with our two generals, Thong Van Dong and Cao Van Vien. Dong was with me in the same government at that time as the defense minister, and General Van Vien, our chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff. My conversations with them, of course, did not give me any hope whatsoever that on the military side we could, you know, try and hold on. So it was with that kind of understanding and impression after, you know, landing in Saigon that I went to see President Hu.
Mm-hmm.
How can I summarize, you know, the hour of discussion I had with President Hu? First of all, he wanted to know whether there were any possibility to avoid, you know, having to deal directly with the communists.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to find out whether diplomatically or whether the U.S. would have a way, you know, to put a stop to the fencing North Vietnamese troops and their tanks, which were in the outskirts of Saigon by that time. And how would the French feel? Because he was under very big pressure from the French ambassador, Mr. Marion, who then together with Ambassador Martin tried to convince President Hu to turn over his power to Big Minh.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I was able to figure out things, I tried to explain to President Hu that there was no possibility whatsoever except the alternative advanced by the French and the American ambassadors, that is for him to resign and hand over his presidential powers to Big Minh. And so we wasted about half an hour by President Hu explaining to me that it would be completely unconstitutional for him to transfer his power to Big Minh, who has no legal, you know, claim on being president of the Republic of Vietnam in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me that he had offered to General Big Minh the possibility to be prime minister, but with the total power, you see, complete power,
mm-hmm.
that he will surrender all his powers to Big Minh, but only as a prime minister.
Right.
I said that Big Minh would not accept that, and nobody would deal with Big Minh in such a case, you see.
Mm-hmm. How well did you know Big Minh?
Not very well, but I had good relations with his group. I met him several times, but I did not, so to say, work with him or discuss anything important mm-hmm. with him.
Did you find him an intelligent man who could make good decisions and power?
Completely. He was completely unable to understand any political issues whatsoever.
Mm.
He was a good guy, that's
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm.
He was the most senior soldier or officer of the Army,
right.
And more or less, you know, admired by the younger generations. And also for the overthrow of Yemen in 1963. But I don't think that anybody, you know, in Saigon thought that he would be of any, help or whatsoever to find a particular solution. He was, in fact, a figurehead for a group of in opposition to Jean Thieu and to the establishment there at that time. And that started with Chairman Nguyen Khanh, who took over from Bích Minh and sent him to exile in Bích Minh State in Bangkok for many years before returning to Vietnam.
Where was President Thieu now?
President Thieu? President Thieu passed away in year 2001, I think in September.
Where was he in 1975 when this was happening? Had he left the country?
Not yet. He left the country only that very evening, I think.
Okay.
On the 25th.
Okay.
Yes, he left on the 25th. But when I returned home, by about 8 o'clock, I think, or 7:30 or 8 o'clock, I got a phone call from him. I didn't know that he was leaving. He just called and said, well, you know, he implied that he's going to leave the country, but he didn't say when and where and how. But then he also mentioned a few names, people that he said that if I had the opportunity to, help them get out of Saigon, I said, sure, if they want to, I would like to find out whether I could help them to get out. But I told him also that I was not going out, and I just returned.
Did he try to talk you out of that?
No, not at all. Not at all. He knew me well enough not to say that.
Okay.
Right, so I went in to see President He, and there was nothing that I could tell him to let him understand that, one, there's no thing forthcoming to save the government of Saigon, and second, the only alternative left to him was just to hand over his power to Bích Minh. So that was, to put it in brief, that was the discussion I had with President He.
Okay.
And of course he had to, he insisted that he had to respect the constitutional procedure. So even if it were, shall we say, unconstitutional for him to hand over power to Bích Minh, he could not do it directly from him to Bích Minh, but he had to surrender his powers to the Congress, to the National Assembly, to the both houses, to then decide to give it to Bích Minh. Which, strictly speaking, was not constitutional. But you can always, claim that Congress can do that. Nothing in the Constitution allowed Congress to do that. So that was it. So I then went home to my parents.
How did you sleep that night?
Oh, we didn't sleep very much because my father liked to talk a lot, and I had seen him for years. So we talked almost, very long in the night. And he was always happy to have me home.
Did your mother cook for you?
Oh, yes. And then we had a big dinner.
Okay.
So that was the situation.
Okay.
And then, of course, afterwards, President He managed to agree with the National Assembly and the Senate to carry out the procedure and hand over power to Bích Minh, which was done at the ceremony in the afternoon of Monday, the 28th of April. And I attended that transfer ceremony. Of course, I think almost all the members of the Saigon government at that time already fled. And if I remember correctly, there was only General Trong Văn Đông, who was the defense minister, who was there still. I was there. there was also a number of others, but they were already on the Viet Cong side. Turned out to be afterwards.
Turned out to be on the Viet Cong?
Yes.
Okay.
For example, you have the... what's his name? Anyway, a number of the government of Saigon, members of the government of Saigon, and they were already in the side of the Viet Cong at that time. But when Viet Minh took over on Monday, in the afternoon of Monday, of course I had discussions with the so-called vice president, lawyer Huynh, Nguyen Nhân Huynh, who was the vice president of Viet Minh.
Right.
And he was made responsible for negotiation with the other side. And at that time, Viet Minh had channels to the Viet Cong delegation in Tân Sĩ Mịch and tried to get in touch with them through lawyer Trần Ngọc Liễn, who was my predecessor at the welfare ministry. I replaced him as Minister of Welfare, but he went a bit Viet Cong too. And he was in contact with the Viet Cong delegation. So, but of course it was just a game by the Viet Cong delegation. It gave the impression that they maintained a kind of a channel for Viet Minh. But even Viet Minh's representatives, Lawyer Liễn and others, were not able to do anything with the Viet Cong delegation in the Tân Sĩ Mịch airport when they were there.
Did you have any official position in this new government?
No. I was just having contacts with, discussions with Lawyer Huynh. But I attended a meeting. It must be just before the power transfer. So that must be Sunday.
Okay.
I would say Sunday.
Okay.
We had a meeting and it was held at the house just outside the Independence Palace. There was General Dong, who was at that time with me in the government as Defense Minister. There was Mr. Nguyễn Xuân Oanh, Dr. Oanh, Jack Owen, as known to his American friends, a former Deputy Prime Minister at the time of Nguyễn Khánh. And there were a number of others. Who turned out to be an old Viet Cong afterwards. But there was that meeting to exchange ideas, you know, what would happen after President He turned over power to Viet Minh, and what would happen after with Viet Minh in summer.
Right.
So after the transfer of power from President Hương to Viet Minh, the first thing that Viet Minh's group did was to demand the complete and immediate departure of all American personnel of the U.S. Embassy, and in particular of the Defense Attaché Office, the AAO. It was repeated almost continuously on the national radio and TV. Which indicated that the other side made that sine qua non condition for Viet Minh to do anything with them, because he could not have any meetings with them. But if he could not get all the Americans out, you know, he would not have any chance to meet anybody on the Viet Cong side.
That was a condition set.
That was a condition.
How were these meetings on Sunday and the ones afterwards? What was the move? Was it cordial?
Yes, very cordial.
Yeah. Very formal?
Very formal, very cordial.
Okay.
No problem.
Okay.
And what was in my mind at that time, the only thing left for me was to have any hope, you know, on the military side. Mm-hmm. Because in my mind at that time, although Thieu permitted the collapse of the Arvin forces from central Vietnam down to Saigon, but to me at that time, the Arvin was completely intact from the south of Saigon, with the Four Corps command completely intact, with the air force of the Four Corps completely intact in Tanok, mm-hmm. hundreds of planes. Mm-hmm. And then you have at least, I would say about 200,000 troops intact in Four Corps. Mm-hmm. So there was no reason why we could not make even the last stand in order to talk, right. just to talk. But it seemed that with the transfer ceremony of President He, I very soon realized that there was no more battle to fight. And that was the general impression in the Arvin generals that I saw, like Cao Văn Viên or Trong Văn Đôn or others. That is, it was not for a fight, but it was to accept the course proposed by the American ambassador and the French ambassador and so on. That is, let you know, big men have a try with the other side for, you know, some kind of an accommodation.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that was at all possible?
I didn't believe in it at all, you see. And it was, in my mind, just a matter of being taken over militarily. And with the obsession of the dreadful bloodbath predicted with the Battle of Saigon.
Why not use the Four Corps troops?
Because there was completely disruption and the absence of the line of command. The headquarters in Tan Sinh Nhuc didn't function anymore.
Okay.
And even if the Four Corps commander, you know, wanted to do something, he expected the general headquarters to direct him, lead
right.
him.
Right.
And with Big Binh, General Vinh Loc was made the head of the army, mm-hmm. you know, to replace General Cao Văn Viên. And even 24 hours after being, named as the replacement of General Cao Văn Viên, General Vinh Loc went to Vũng Tàu and fled away. So there was a complete void at the headquarters of the army in Tân Sinh Nhuc. And the sad thing, that is, the commanding general of the Four Corps in Cần Thơ, I think it was Jean Hưng, he decided in the end to put on his gala uniform and committed suicide, mm-hmm. instead of putting on a fight. And even in the whole of the Delta area, there were no North Vietnamese troops, you see. And most of the so-called troops who went into those army headquarters and took over those barracks were just, mainly youngsters, mm-hmm. almost unarmed, mm-hmm. came there, took over power from those generals and colonels. So it was, that was why, I was convinced and still hold that Thieu's resignation was the message to his troops, to the Arvin troops, that there's no fight anymore. Mm-hmm. And you have to follow the U.S. Mm-hmm. Suggestion that we have to find a way out, without fighting.
Mm-hmm. Personally, why do you think Thieu resigned?
Well, I think he resigned in the end because it came to a point, and under very strong pressure from Ambassador Martin, mm-hmm. on the 20th of April, mm-hmm. that was, shall we say, the dead limit, I think, for the U.S. They thought that after that would be too late, mm-hmm. to find any peaceful solution. Till waited, I think, until then. They waited since the beginning of the year for any sign or any intervention by the U.S. Militarily, mm-hmm. to put a check to the advance of the North Vietnamese, troops. But then I think he came to the point that he realized, I think, by the April the 20th and 21st when he resigned, and that President Ford was very different from President Johnson and Nixon.
In what way?
Well, that is to say that he would not take very harsh, measures or action. Mm-hmm. And he was no longer in a position to do it, too.
Did you ever have any contact with President Ford?
Not at all. Okay. Not at all.
Okay.
So there was the situation. And I think, generally speaking, the general public was not very aware of the situation.
Really?
Talking to the people in Saigon, even in the government circles, I found out that they were, not very well informed of how things were, happening. And I had much better information from Paris on Saigon than the people in Saigon themselves. Huh. You see?
Wasn't the information on the radio?
Well, the radio didn't say much.
To a point, yes.
Didn't say much. And the U.S. Embassy didn't provide any information. And I think that by that time, the intelligence network, even of the CIA, was falling down very fast. Mm-hmm. And there were some, I'm sure, lots of, disinformation channeled into those people, mm-hmm. because it turned out that they were not very much informed, and the few information they had were not accurate at all.
This is the common people of Saigon?
Yeah. No, even in the government circles.
Really?
Even in the government circles.
Did you get the feeling that on the streets the people were aware that the situation was imminent and that Saigon and the government was going to fall?
Yes, that would be a very, interesting thing to study. The attitude and the thinking and, how people behaved in those last days of Saigon. Mm-hmm. Of course, I can only describe the feelings I found in my family. Mm-hmm. They were, of course, very afraid, mm-hmm. with the advance of the communist troops at the gates of Saigon.
Right.
But I think in my family, they thought that, the Arvin would be in position to put up a defense of Saigon while waiting for something else to happen, or big men to find a peaceful solution. But you have been indoctrinated for years that, the Arvin with 1 million troops and with all the sophisticated weapons from the U.S. and 2,000 planes of the Vietnamese Air Force, I mean, you can defend Saigon somehow, you mm-hmm. see. So they were not too worried. I was much worried militarily, speaking, compared to the people in my family. My parents, they were completely, untouched by those things. They were not interested.
Really? What kind of conversations did you have with them about?
They talk about, very personal things. How are you? How you feel? And things mm-hmm. like that. And they ask about family things.
Right.
But with my parents, we never discussed political subjects or anything.
How do they feel about you being in the government and having such an important position all those years?
Oh, to them it was not a big deal. It was not a big deal. I mean, to be in the government or to remain with ESSO would be the same thing to them for me. That is to say, they wanted me to have a good life and something of that thing, mm-hmm. generally speaking. Mm-hmm. And some be happy. But they had never been impressed, you know, being a member of the government or anything of that kind.
Did they realize the danger that you were in personally?
Apprehensive of what would happen if the communists took over. Mm-hmm. But I think that somehow they were not really, to say, horrified or afraid really by the second bloodbath. I have the impression that my parents were never, convinced that there would be a bloodbath. Probably because they thought that between Vietnamese, you don't do things like that. Mm-hmm. It would be, beyond their imagination, mm-hmm. that between Vietnamese you could go and slaughter one another. Mm-hmm. And that way it was inconceivable for them.
Did they not keep up with what was happening with the war, say in the atrocities?
Yeah, in the
40s.
In the 40s.
In the 40s.
Yeah, in the 40s. There were atrocities there. Mm-hmm. But to them it was, isolated cases, in certain hamlets or villages or here and there. But it was not a national thing. It was not a national calamity that you had big, movement of liquidation. Mm-hmm. It was a very serious liquidation, but I think to them it was not something extremely widespread.
Had they heard about what happened in Hue in 1968?
Yes, they did. But you had so much propaganda stuff from the Saigon government, mm-hmm. and what happened in Hue was, something like quite common from the Viet Cong. Thousands of cases of assassinations have been reported over the time.
Right. So after the transfer of power ceremony, what did you do?
I stayed home. I had a few meetings with Lawyer Hue. But, of course, I didn't say much to him or anything. I said I would be prepared to help him, mm-hmm. Find out a solution. And then I reported to him, what was the La Saint-Cloud conference between the two South Vietnamese parties after the Paris Agreement. We had that, which didn't move anywhere, of course, because mm-hmm. it was, again, Thieu's reluctance completely to share power in any way, mm-hmm. but we tried to implement the Paris Agreement by discussing those political articles in the Paris Agreement, and it was, of course, the most concrete thing was National Reconciliation Council, and it was understood that it would be divided in equally in three groups, one from the NLF, one from the Saigon government, and one so-called third force neutral. Mm-hmm. And we spent weeks and months to discuss how we are going to name those people. And various formulas were put out, whether we just name our own people in the council, and then half of the third force they name and half of the third force we name, or that both sides dress up a common list and then we pick up from the common list, mm-hmm. and things like that. There will be endless discussions about mm-hmm. it, even before discussing what would be the responsibilities and priorities of that council. What would that council do? Mm-hmm. We start even for how to name that council to begin with, and could not even agree on that one. But I think that neither side was really interested to reach any agreement, mm-hmm. because we didn't believe in it at all. Mm-hmm.
So This is Sunday the 26th, Monday the 27th.
Monday 28th.
Monday the 28th.
Yes.
The 29th and the 30th.
And then for 48 hours, yeah. Whitman just kept on asking the U.S. to withdraw completely because it was, you know, necessary for the Hanoi government to have all the Americans out.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do in those 48 hours? You met
upon those few meetings and seeing a few people who came to see me, I stayed home.
Okay. So, awaiting your faith.
Yes. But then after the transfer ceremony on Monday evening, then there was a very important shelling of Saigon, mm-hmm. you know, and most of the shelling were on Tan Son Nhut, on the Harbin headquarters and so mm-hmm. on. And then by the late morning of Monday, mm-hmm. the airport was condemned with the first shelling. You know, the runway couldn't be used anymore, and that was the time that Ambassador Martin had to move to the helicopter evacuation from downtown.
Right.
And I had a phone call with Ambassador Martin on Tuesday, I think by noontime or something. I called Eva Kim, his secretary, that we have known forever. Eva Kim eventually, I think, went to work at the United Nations. But I had a discussion, I had a phone conversation with Ambassador Martin on Tuesday, that is about 10, 15 hours before the very end when he left. And he insisted that try and find ways to take me out of Saigon. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask him, but I very much try and ask him whether there is a possibility how to stop the North Vietnamese troops at the gates of Saigon. Pending, any possibility by Big Minh to find an accommodation with the Viet Cong, mm-hmm. the Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. So, and then in the middle of our conversation, I heard the voice of Dr. Kissinger on a loudspeaker from the other end of the phone. Mm-hmm. And then Ambassador Martin, said he's sorry, he has to cut. He will call me back right away. He never called.
Back.
No, he was too busy afterwards. With the very last.
Uh-huh. Was it the last time you talked with him?
Yes, okay. Last time. Though. And then many of the remaining government members of Saigon tried to get out mm-hmm. and went to the U.S. Embassy. Of course, mm-hmm. I heard about it. One of them was German from London. Many of them had to climb the fences mm-hmm. in order to get in.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, with your offer to be able to leave, did you reconsider at all?
I didn't think of leaving at all because my parents did not have any idea, any intention to leave at all. It was out of the question for them to leave their homes and so on and so forth. And I think that I came to their thinking. That is, say, well, whatever happened, we would stay there. That's because we have a very large family,
right?
So,
right. How far away was your family home from the U.S. Embassy? Your family home is.
Oh yes, in the third district. We've been there for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And if you drive by car, it would be about 10 minutes.
Now, on the 30th, did you hear the commotion in the streets and what was happening while you were at home?
Oh yes, because we knew that North Vietnamese troops and tanks came in.
Right.
Very early. But there was no fighting in the street at all. I mean, very soon they found out that the North Communist troops there and the tanks there found out that there was no resistance whatsoever from the Arvin. Mm-hmm. You see, and there was no army of the Arvin in Saigon. Mm-hmm. And most of them, I think, have took off their uniform and stay home or went home. Or, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no fighting at all. Except for a few little, you know, skirmishes in various places, but not in downtown. I didn't hear any.
When did you first hear about the Independence Palace gates being, you know, the taking of the palace by the
troops? Oh, right away, because, you know, people in our house, they went in and out of the house freely and circulate. And many of them came back, and a succession of them came back to and, let us know that they have moved in, they have taken position at the crossroads and things like that. And there was nothing to really to upset, you know, the life in the streets. You know, our neighbors were there, and it was almost normal because we did not have the tanks in our district. Our area, they were downtown rather. But then we saw in the streets the cars and jeeps with the flags of the Viet Cong, and then with people on those rushing very fast back and forth in the street like this. But in our street there was nothing. They didn't stop there because there was nothing there. There was no police station, there was no army base, anything near there. And so it was almost normal. And then I think by noon, a little bit after lunch, I think, one problem. Now, whether we used to have early lunch, but I think that day we didn't have early lunch. And then I sneak out of the house in a walk.
You snuck out of the house?
Yeah. And then I went downtown. I went downtown, and it was a very funny thing. I walked, you know, completely, and then eventually I went to Independence Palace, and then I saw the North Vietnamese troops and the tanks there, standing there. So the people were still very careful, you know. They did not rush out, welcome the arriving troops. They were curious to see how those troops would behave, you know, with all the propaganda they had from Saigon. I think it's understandable. But then I found out that there were the tanks there near the Independence Palace, and then I did not get near too near Independence Palace, but nearer to the cathedral. I was standing there in the post office, and the tanks were there. And then I discovered those North Vietnamese troops. They were just, you know, kids, youngsters, very skinny. That impressed me. They were all very skinny, pale, tired, and so on. So they were standing there looking around. No troops to fight.
Did you talk with any of them?
No, I didn't talk to them. But I just looked at them in the air, you know. So some of them also look at me, but that's it. And eventually I went to the post office and called home. That's how I'm all right, don't worry, you know, I'll be home very, very soon. And there was not much, you know, disruption. The phone worked normally, electricity, water, nothing, you know, except for the presence of those troops. And then those so-called Viet Cong rushing around, you know, but what we call later on the 25th hour Viet Cong. Everybody became Viet Cong after that. And then on my way back, it was really, you know, funny, because it's quite by car from my home to Independence Palace, it would take about 10 minutes, but maybe I walk, it would be more than half an hour. And then I tried to get the signal. But there was no ciclo, and there was a three-wheeler, you know, the kind of that cart that they put merchandise on with the guy at the back, you know, peddling. And then I saw a guy there in his shorts only, you know, almost his panties. And so it turned out that he had a uniform, a Saigon uniform, but he took it off, you know, and he was in his panties, peddling, you know, that three-wheeled cart. And so I waved him. You see, I said, can you give me a ride? Mm-hmm. He was very happy to give me a ride, but didn't say a word, nodded. And so I jumped on the front, mm-hmm. sat there with my legs hanging out, mm-hmm. because I asked him whether he was going in the direction of my home. He nodded, and then I just come on and continue to, you know, pedal mm-hmm. very hard. Mm-hmm. Of course, in a hurry. And then he was very skinny too.
Right.
Very skinny too. Then he went out of breath. He could hardly pedal because the car was heavy.
Right.
You see? And so I said, well, he can hardly move anymore. But we were halfway home. So I said, okay, you sit, I pedal. And so we changed place. Right. And then I pedaled the thing home. Then I gave it back the car to him when into the house. Yeah.
So you became a cyclo driver there.
Just yeah, I became a cyclo driver on that very historical day.
That's interesting. So when you got back home, did you tell your parents what you
had
seen?
Oh, yes, I told them what I saw, and mm-hmm. well, there's not much disruption. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any fighting, and the kind of troops I saw, and the tanks there, mm-hmm. the 54 Soviet tanks there, and that was it. I think that was also the general impression of everybody, mm-hmm. was that they just, you know, wait and see. Of course, the new administration authorities tried to organize, you know, festivities and so on, but it took 7 days to organize those things. But most people were, you know, careful to stay home mm-hmm. and wait to see how they would be treated and so on and so forth. But it became more and more astonishing to me that nothing really drastic happened, you know, drastic happened.
Were you expecting something drastic to happen?
Oh, yes. I mean, for, you know, the troops to call, round up people, and then jail them, or I don't know.
Did you expect them to come to your home?
Oh,
did
yes.
You?
I expected they to come and look for me, you mm-hmm. see, because in the area, in the prison, people knew very well our house, and that I was there. And nothing happened. And we were able to go to the market the next day and then to circulate. Nobody, you know, came to ask for anything at all. Mm-hmm. And then the relatives arrived very soon, you know, the next 2 or 3 days. My uncles returned from Hanoi, arrived, came, mm-hmm. and we had big festivities.
Yes.
And then the...
You all welcomed them?
Oh, yes. They were very happy to see us, too. Mm-hmm. And they never had big meals before for years, you see. So.
Right.
And we all enjoy. And of course, we. My father was responsible for the ancestors' altar, that is for everybody in the family. So those uncles and all those relatives came back and, you know, paid the respects to the ancestors in the so-called ancestors' home, mm-hmm. you know, because that was our duty, mm-hmm. my father's duty, to keep the altar of the ancestors. So we had those festivities in the spirit of the ancestors, mm-hmm. nothing to do with the liberation of the
right.
country or, and so on. So that was the spirit. And then the following days, I went with those uncles to various government headquarters, mm-hmm. because they didn't know where I was, where and what, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, I took them to the Foreign Affairs. It was just in the front of Independence Palace. It was completely deserted, of course, so we had a tour in there. So it used to be the Foreign Affairs Ministry of Saigon. Mm-hmm. That was it, you see. Mm-hmm. And then I showed them the Ministry of Welfare, Ministry of Labor, various places where I was there. Mm-hmm. They were also, impressed by the life in Saigon. And then I also took them to the restaurant and so on, so mm-hmm. they discovered, you know, the capitalist ways of life.
How much discussion did you, what did you talk about with them? Did you ask?
Oh, we talked mainly about the family. And they did not say anything about the defeat of the Saigon government on about the defeat of the Americans and so on and so forth. But with my parents, the general mood was that, well, at least the end of the war. Mm-hmm. That was the general feeling.
And the family was back together.
And the family was back again, you see. And then we also had the impression that life would be very hard. Would be very hard. But we were back again. We were on together again. Mm-hmm. And we'll make the best out of it.
Had you saved some money for this situation?
Personally, I didn't save any. I didn't have any money to save, you know, when I was in Paris for all these years with the Paris Peace Talks. That's to say, about 7 years mm-hmm. I was there. I had just a per diem allowance of $50 a day. And that was all. I was not a civil servant. I was not an army officer. Mm-hmm. All of them in the Saigon government administration were either a civil servant or an army officer with security and salary. I was what it was called a notable. That is to say, I participated supposedly from the political, you know, reasons.
So you weren't drawing a salary?
I didn't have any salary whatsoever. Why I was with the Saigon government for 10 continuous years.
Why?
Because I was not a civil servant or an army officer.
But you were doing such important work for the government.
It's a political assignment.
They would try to pay you.
A political assignment.
That's all. Almost like a volunteer political assignment.
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. Probably they follow the American practice, a symbolic dollar a year or something. But anyway, that was it. And $50 a day for you.
While we've been talking,
and then the relatives found out that very soon, because there were, you know, fires and so on, that I didn't possess anything, no house, no car, no salary, nothing at all.
Were they surprised?
Well, they were very surprised.
They expect you to be rich.
Yeah, they expect me to be rich, and that I should have, you know, bank accounts and things. I didn't even have a bank account. With $50 a day, you don't have a bank account. Mm-hmm.
While we've been talking, your mood has been pretty jovial. You've had a good attitude about the fall of your country. Can I ask why you feel that way now? And were you sad then, or were you more accepting then?
I was, of course, very sad by the fall of Saigon. Because I was always convinced, you know, that communist rule would be catastrophic for the country, you know. And not that only I was not convinced that their system would work, but in practice, I mean, with the Stalinian, you know, kind of rule in the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and then with Mao in China, mm-hmm. Economic success was not, you know, something very familiar with the communist rulers.
Right.
And so I was distraught in that sense. But on the other hand, I mean, there was the end of the killing of the war. Mm-hmm. So maybe that was just fate. And I was really surprised by lack of reprisal or harsh measures after the North Vietnamese troops took over. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I had the impression that the North Vietnamese officials were much more, shall we say, lenient to the Saigon, you know, officials and administration people, and then the Viet Cong. Mm-hmm. I think the Viet Cong probably had more reasons to be harder, you know, mm-hmm. on those Saigon people, mm-hmm. Than the Hanoi people. Mm-hmm. And of course, life continued to be, you know, almost normal. But we were all very curious what would happen, because I suppose that it took time for them to organize themselves. Mm-hmm. And eventually you have the decree that the requirements that all the former Saigon people had to undergo re-education.
Did you expect this?
And then there was, of course, discussions about avoiding higher education, although it was only supposedly for 30 days. But it was discussed in the family with my brother and with my sister and so on, whether I should go or whether I should not go. And in the end, my parents did not participate in those discussions at all. But in the end, I informed my parents that I decided to pick up the request to undergo the 30-day re-education as decreed by the new authorities.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents just accepted that.
If you, and why did you decide
the uncles were there too, you mm-hmm. see. Says, yeah, you just go to your education. It's nothing. It's nothing much.
Did they know differently?
And they really also believed it was for 30 days.
Okay.
You see. Everybody believed it.
Was there really an alternative to not go?
Well, you can flee.
They
because
would
people continue to try and get out of the country.
Okay.
And it was still possible in the Delta area because there was nothing there yet.
Right.
You see, and people, you can take a boat and get out.
Right.
Even from Saigon, there were people who tried after the 30th of April to get on boats and get out.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were not really organized to do anything. They cannot govern yet.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so there was nothing. It was a void. For at least, I would say, a couple of weeks. There was nothing, completely. There was no administration whatsoever.
And you stayed at home? And
I stayed at home, and then I went around town, and with my uncles, we went around town, and things like that. There was not much of a disruption.
Why don't we take a break with this?
Okay.